life goes on along its merry way. We're looking for the good times, the fun and the play, while inside is an aching that won't go away. And we wonder why in heaven are we here today. We fight with our children, wives and husbands too, angry hurtful feelings running clear through. How much more we have to suffer through. The daily news tells our story, sad but true, of violence and killing and wars planned anew, of child abuse and battering done by men the world through. Women wonder why must we be here too. It's hard to watch the pain and strife go on. The cries of our children lost in the din. But until men's hearts are opened to the love that lies within, there can be no peace on earth, no joyful life so true. It's the only way to heaven and peace on earth too. And so I tell you in words straight and true, open up your heart to the pain that covers you.
Hello, I'm Janie Reisner, and welcome to Women's Voices. My esteemed guest this evening is Loretta Ross, a founder and national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, a growing network of Native American, Latina, American, African American, Asian American, and other women of color groups doing collectively what we cannot do individually. Sister Song's mission is to connect reproductive rights to human rights. Ross co-coordinated production of the path-breaking statement, "We Remember, African American Women Are for Reproductive Freedom." Ross's areas of expertise are reproductive rights, human rights, women's issues, diversity issues, hate groups, and bias crimes. Loretta was one of the first African-American women to direct the first rapes crisis center in the United States in 1970. Soon after enrolling at Howard University in 1970, Ross became involved in black nationalist politics and tenant organizing in Washington, D.C. the murder of her friend and political colleague Yolanda Ward in November 1980, which she considers a political assassination, was a turning point in her life. Women's human rights are of significant concern for Ross because she was sterilized at age 23. Ross was also one of the first black women to win a suit against A.H. Robbins, manufacturer of the Dalkin Shield that sterilized thousands of women. She was the co-director of the 2004 National March for Women's Lives in Washington, D.C., the largest protest in U.S. history. She is also the co-author of Undivided Right, Women of Color Organizing for Reproductive Justice, 2004, South End Press. Loretta was invited to testify before the U.S. Congress, the United Nations, and the Food and Drug Administration on women's health and human rights issues. She served 8 years on the Washington, D.C. Commission for Women. She currently serves on the Board of Directors for the Foundation of African American Women, the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, the Committee on Women, Population, and the Environment, and Sister Love Women's AIDS Project. She serves as a political analyst for Pacifica News Service and Alternative Radio, and has appeared on talk shows such as The Donahue Show, The Charlie Rose Show, CNN, BET Lead Show, and Good Morning America. Loretta received an honorary Doctorate of Civil Law degree in 2003 from Arcadia University. Welcome to Women's Voices, Loretta.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thank you for being here and for staying up late. You're in Atlanta, right?
Yes, we're on East Coast time, so it's all good.
Great. The first question I ask my guests, given that this is Women's Voices, is what part did your mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today?
Well, she played a very positive and probably an inadvertent part at the same time. My mother, and I also have to pay tribute to my dad, they had 8 kids and 5 boys and 3 girls.
Wow.
And my mother rather loved her sons and raised her daughters in that old patriarchal model.
Wow.
Which, of course, is extremely frustrating if you're one of the girls. But at the same time, it was a warm and loving and very supportive family. My mother never had a chance to fulfill her own career ambitions. She was first a domestic worker and then basically a housewife. But she was well-read, so she always encouraged me to learn and to read and kind of pushed all her kids towards college because she never had a chance to go herself. And so I think that really gave me a love of learning for the all of my life. I mean, I used to hide under the bed covers with a flashlight and read long after she would try to make me go to bed. At the same time, she was a devout Christian woman, Southern Baptist, so she was dealing with some very difficult issues around sex and sexuality. I found out years after I worked at the Rape Crisis Center that she herself had been a victim of child sexual abuse, starting at age 8.
Mm.
And that explained a whole lot that happened to me while I was growing up and her reaction to it, because I also had a son through incest, and I couldn't understand this manic reaction that she had. But it really was an echo of her own life, things that had happened to her.
Yeah.
And so she had very strong influences on my life and on my choices. And I had that baby I was 14 when I became pregnant, 15 when I ended up having my son. And I was supposed to give him up for adoption, but I chose to keep him. And so she co-parented with me. And as a result, I have a wonderful son and a wonderful grandson. And so through the hard times and through the good times, Mom was always there. She died almost 4 years ago now, and I certainly miss her. But I had the best of childhoods in terms of having both Mom and Dad really be there for their kids. Even though they didn't have, as I say, a lot of education themselves, they made sure that they could push all of us. one of the things that was important, because what happens to parents that don't have a chance to go to college is they don't know how to send a child to college because they've never done it themselves. And so I remember getting on that bus going from Texas to Washington, D.C. to go to Howard University. Mom gave me a couple of $100s and just basically said, do your best, but she really didn't have any real skills in how to send a child to college. But that didn't stop her from being really proud of me. And actually, when she died, we discovered this cedar chest where she had created like a memento box for each one of her 8 kids, all the things we'd ever done in life. Uh-huh. And it was just, she was just a special woman. I hope that she always understands how much we love and appreciate her.
Yeah, what a great mom.
She was. She was really, really great. Absolutely devoted to her kids. For a little independent soul like me, I could almost say too much so. But she used to say, well, I have a son that's a pharmacist, and I have another son that's a preacher, and then I have a daughter named Loretta, and she doesn't go to jail. Because she could never really understand how you could make a career being a social justice activist.
I bet. One other piece about your growing up, you were a bright little girl. You were double promoted in elementary grades, an honor student in high school.
Done your homework.
I have. And when you were just 11 years old, you were beaten and raped by a stranger.
Yes, I was on a Girl Scout outing. You know, my mother also pushed us into volunteering and Girl Scout outing, and I was at this amusement park with my Girl Scout troop and somehow got separated and got lost. And so this stranger offered to give me a ride home. And, of course, I probably shouldn't have done it. Matter of fact, I know I shouldn't have done it. But I got into his car, and he took me into the woods, and he decided to rape me. Wow. Now, I have to honestly say, as terrifying as that experience was, because he beat me and he raped me, he also was one of those guys that actually thought he was doing me a favor, because after it was all over, he asked me where I lived and took me home.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
And so I could have been a body in the woods.
Oh, my God. How amazing.
And the fact that he delivered me home and had kind words to say, I mean, he was really kind of a twisted soul. But I guess it wasn't my destiny to end up in the woods.
I guess it wasn't. And I guess he probably didn't feel fear, any reaction from anybody. You know?
Well, I didn't know his name. And,
of course.
At the time, I was so deeply ashamed. I came home with these bloody white jeans on, and my poor mother thought that I had just merely started my period. Mm. She really didn't know what had happened, and I was too afraid to tell her. And I actually didn't tell her until 3 years later when I was pregnant. Well, I told her kind of like the whole history of all the abuse and stuff that had happened to me. Mm-hmm. And she didn't believe me at first, and then she didn't want to believe me after a while. And then we finally made peace with it. And my son was, I think about 11 or 12 years old when she finally told me the story of what had happened to her.
For goodness sakes.
After I worked at the Rape Crisis Center, she decided that I was the safe child to tell.
Wow.
And none of my brothers or sisters had ever heard the story. As a matter of fact, I just told my brother about it a few days ago because he didn't know that aspect of our mother's lives.
And she probably never told anyone either, unless perhaps your father.
Well, my father may have known, but the same uncle that abused her, because they lived in this big farmhouse where all the generations lived together, he also abused her sisters, too. So they shared this secret.
I see. I'm just so sorry that you had to suffer through all that. You know, we all know that is not how life is supposed to be. However, when we consider that 1 out of 3 children has been sexually abused in this patriarchal world, it happens all too often.
Well, I'm just lucky enough that I was in the right city at the right time, because when the D.C. Rape Crisis Center opened in 72 and I became involved in it in 1979, I found a community of feminists who gave me words to describe what had happened to me, because really I thought it was all my fault. I was deeply ashamed. I couldn't tell anybody. And then when we started naming things like child sexual abuse and sexual exploitation and, you know, developing the first protocol for how rape victims should be treated and how law enforcement should deal with rape victims and stuff. It was very empowering to be in the beginning of a movement that could name some of the trauma that we'd gone through, but also rename ourselves not as victims, but as survivors, people who are going to make a difference in the world because of what had happened to us. And so, in a weird kind of way, I don't regret any of it because I know I wouldn't be the person I am today without it.
I know. That's absolutely true. Isn't it amazing how life works? I thought, too, that if you hadn't kept your baby, you know, then when you're 23, you're sterilized. So how wonderful that you did choose to keep your baby.
It was totally an accident that I kept him. I mean, obviously, I was in.
You were 15 years old.
Augustine, you want to hear all this nasty stuff?
Well,
so I was placed in a home for unwed mothers because in the 60s it was very common to hide girls away who were pregnant, and then they'd have the baby, give the baby up for adoption, and then return to their lives as if they'd been on an extended vacation.
Yeah.
Except that the nurses in the hospital where I had my son made the mistake and brought me my son the morning after delivery for nursing.
Huh.
Wow. And I looked at him, I kept saying, he's got my face, he's got my face, he's got my face. And after that, I couldn't go through with it. And that's why I get a little angry when people talk about how easy adoption is, when in fact, it is one of the most difficult things a woman can ever do is give a baby up, particularly when she's held that baby.
Of course.
And so I ended up keeping my son because that wasn't, you know, incest wasn't my route to parenting. It wasn't my plan.
Right.
But a few years later, as you said, I accepted a Dalkon shield, much to my regret, and it ended up sterilizing me. So who would have known that child I had then would be my only child?
Your only child. Just back to people giving up their babies. Of course, I think that, I mean, I've read about it for all their life. They remember this birth and remember the child's birthday, perhaps. I mean, probably not in all instances, but of course it is a profound experience to do that.
Well, the irony of it is that I had my son on April 9th, but he'll tell you now, 41 years later, his mama has trouble remembering his birthday.
Well, that's because he's here.
Exactly.
You know, I wore that Dalkon shield for a little while. I didn't like it, and I had it removed, but God forbid, you know.
Well, you were the lucky one. My problem was that my body accepted it for 5 years with no real visible problem until I developed the acute pelvic inflammatory disease.
And that's very dangerous.
The PID, and then I ran into a racist doctor who told me I had some kind of exotic STD or venereal disease. The Dalkon shield had nothing to do with it until my fallopian tubes exploded. And then all of a sudden he had to do a hysterectomy to save my life. You know, it was one of those things. But not only did I sue A.H. Robbins, but I sued the hospital and bought my first house with the proceeds.
Good for you.
As I say, there always is lemonade to be made.
Yes, and you obviously you dared to do all that, and you stood up for yourself in all of that. And again, this comes from a really strong background, I think.
And a support circle, because I had a great doctor who was my previous doctor. I had this bad doctor because I was in an HMO. When I talk about health care reform, but before I got into the HMO, I had a great doctor. So he was the one that read my medical records and say, everything that happened to you was wrong. You should sue these people.
Good for him. Good for him. Okay. Well, thank you for all of that. It's just lovely to hear it all. Could you talk about the theory of reproductive justice and what that means exactly and what Sister Song is about?
Well, reproductive justice was a phrase that a group of black women created in 1994. We were at this pro-choice conference in Illinois, and at the time, health care reform was being proposed by the Clinton administration, and they unwisely thought that if they stayed silent on abortion rights, that somehow they could sneak health care reform past the Republicans. Where have we heard that before? And so at this conference, a group of us caucused in somebody's hotel room, and we were angry that they were going to try to omit abortion coverage from health care reform, and we were really concerned about its impact specifically on women of color and low-income women, because we already had the Hyde Amendment. And so we decided to publish a statement in the Washington Post and really protest the omission of abortion rights from health care reform. And the other thing that concerned us was that abortion, it is often isolated from the social justice issues that really contextualize it. I mean, every time a woman is pregnant, before she even makes the decision whether to have the baby or not, she's worried about whether she has health care, whether she can keep her job, whether her partner will be pleased or mad because she's pregnant, whether she can tell her parents. I mean, this whole range of feelings goes through one when you're pregnant long before you decide, can I be a mother or can I keep this baby? And so to isolate the decision whether or not to keep a pregnancy or not from the context in which women actually live their lives never really made sense to us as black women, because every decision about our body is deeply affected by the communities in which we're embedded. If we're in a community that lacks health care, or if we're in a community that's subjected to immigration raids, all of these kinds of things affect our reproductive decisions. And so we took the phrase reproductive rights and we took the phrase social justice, smashed them together, and came up with reproductive justice to signify how you have to embed the concept of abortion in a social justice framework. And then in 1994, that same year, there was the International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo, Egypt. And one of the things we had noticed was that women internationally used the human rights framework to lay claim to the social justice issues that we were talking about, where in the U.S., mostly people use the privacy framework, you know, keep your laws off my body. But it didn't really speak to what obligations society in general and the government has to ensure that you actually can make decisions and can enjoy reproductive freedom. So by putting together the phrase and then packing it with all these human rights values that we learned from the global women's movement, we began to offer this phrase to what was really then the radical progressive wing of the pro-choice movement. And next thing we knew, everybody started liking the phrase, so much so that Sister Song in 2003 had to enlarge our membership beyond women of color because the radical white women wanted to join us. So now Sister Song is everybody. And then in 1997, 3 years later, a group of 16 women of color organizations came together to form the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective. And so we embrace reproductive justice as our framework, and then the story just unfolded from there. And now we're 80 organizations from the original 16. Our headquarters is in Atlanta. We bought our own office building a couple of years ago, so we're really, really proud of that. And reproductive justice has become probably the most exciting development in the pro-choice movement in a while, because it's proven its ability to bring a lot of new voices into the movement, a new way of thinking into the movement based on the human rights framework that was not there before. And so now, just ironically, even though we created this framework as a way to talk about human rights within the U.S., because we're in a country that doesn't like to talk about its obligations towards its citizens through a human rights lens, I have been in Canada, in Ireland, I heard somebody was in Peru, and they're talking about reproductive justice internationally, oh. The phrase.
Oh, wonderful.
And so it's kind of surprising, those of us who were in its creation and its birthing, because we didn't think that we could make it work in the U.S. We were totally surprised that women internationally are saying the same thing, that you cannot separate family planning, to use that rather sterile term, from poverty, from underdevelopment, from violence, from war. All the things that we talk about is really resonating around the world.
Yes, of course. It does only make sense. To separate it out doesn't make any sense at all. It's wonderful. By the way, your building, it's a house, isn't it, in Atlanta? It was.
It's an old mansion that was built in 1900.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it has kind of interesting story attached to it. It was probably built by a rich Jewish family at the turn of the century, or the turn of the last century. And then there was the lynching of Leo Frank, who was a Jewish man accused of killing a white woman, which kind of led to the founding of B'nai B'rith, the Anti-Defamation League.
Uh-huh.
But what it ended up doing was depopulating this section of Atlanta called the West End, where a lot of the Jewish families moved out further out into the suburbs, and they left behind about a half a dozen of these fabulous mansions. And we're lucky enough to be the owners, co-owners, I should add, because Sister Love Women's AIDS Project co-owns the building with us, of one of these mansions where we've established the Sister Song offices.
That's wonderful. Beautiful. Could you give your website?
Yes, it's very simple, sistersong.net.
Mm-hmm.
And Sister Song is all one word.
And it just has, your website just has all kinds of articles, and it just is wonder. It has lots and lots to offer. I want to say that it's almost 7:30. This is KZYXNZ. I'm Janie Reisner. I'm here with my guest, Loretta Ross. We are speaking about reproductive justice. There are three elemental, what do I want to say? The theory. Could you describe that?
Reproductive justice for us emanates from three basic, what we call our core values. It's every woman's human right to both not have a child, and we share that agenda with the pro-choice movement, so a woman is allowed to practice birth control, to terminate a pregnancy through abortion, or to practice abstinence if she can hold on. I mean,
right.
However you want to not have a child, not have sex, whatever. But because we come from communities of color that are particularly affected by various strategies of population control, whether that's immigration restrictions or the criminal justice system or sterilization abuses or welfare abuse, whatever, we have to fight equally hard for the right to have a child. And we are always up against what some of us call the neo-eugenics movement, people who are always rationalizing why women of color should not be pregnant or should not have kids, and not really valuing the motherhood of women of color.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we have the child, our third core value is that we have the human right to parent our children. We come from communities like the indigenous communities that had forced removal of their kids. As a matter of fact, I was in Vancouver this weekend, and a First Nations woman told me that 30,000 kids are in the custody of British Columbia that have been forcibly removed from First Nation mothers. Today, 30,000 kids are still being forcibly removed from their mothers on all kinds of trumped-up excuses and stuff. And so the right to parent our children in safe environments, in healthy communities, without fear of violence, is something we cannot take for granted. So our core values are the right to have a child, a right not to have a child, and a right to parent our children. So if you ever want to know what's the core definition of reproductive justice, that's it.
Mm-hmm. It's a good definition. It's a wonderful definition. How outrageous that this is happening to these mothers and their children in Canada.
Well, of course it happens here, but of course we do have more protections in some ways because the forced removal of Indigenous children is being strongly protested, of course, by Native American women and the people who really work on this issue because they can see what a dislocation of soul that happens when that occurs. Sure. And the break with the traditions and the family and the spirit and the environment. One of our members named Gudgie Cook has created this concept of the womb as the first environment a baby experiences. And as a result, when you think of that perfect concept, you have to worry about the environmental toxins that are around the mother. What type of culture and traditions and spirituality and healing and sustenance and all of those things really are embodied in that first womb, that womb is the first environment concept. Mm-hmm. And we carry that spirit in our hearts and in our work.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why people say, well, Sister Song, you don't just work on abortion. Oh, I should also say, amongst the 16 organizations that founded Sister Song, some are pro-choice, some are pro-life. So we actually work across that so-called abortion divide together to work for communities of color.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Excuse me. You say that that's happening, that children are being taken from their mothers here, too.
Oh, absolutely. First of all, in vulnerable communities, and I'm not just talking about women of color because you could be low income. Mixed race children are particularly vulnerable. The state seems to think that it can do a better job of parenting our kids than mostly we can. Now, I'm not talking about kids subjected to neglect or child abuse. I'm talking about a community in Virginia, for example, because they are suffering from all kinds of racism and xenophobia around Mexican immigrants, they decided that it is child abuse anytime male children and female children don't have separate bedrooms. And so if you don't have a separate bedroom for each gender of your child, then you can be subjected to having your children removed. So they're using housing zoning ordinances as an excuse to claim child abuse and then removing kids. Now, as I said, I'm one of eight kids. The boys had a room, the girls had a room, mom and dad had a room. But if we had only lived in a two-bedroom apartment, we still would have figured it out. Nobody would have said, you're abusing your child because you don't have enough bedrooms. But that's the kind of laws that communities of color are dealing with now when racism and xenophobia and anti-immigrant hysteria combine to bring the power of the state to determine how we should parent, under what conditions we should parent, and what artificial standards that always change we must meet in order to be deemed good parents.
Yeah, yes.
And a lot of people, I'm sure, that are listening didn't necessarily have what you called, you know, the Ozzie and Harriet upbringing, but who would accuse their parents of child abuse because, you know, my family didn't always have enough food or we didn't have enough clothes. We wore hand-me-downs and things. Under these present constructs, if you're dealing with a hostile state, those will be signs and evidence of child abuse.
Yeah, yeah. It's outrageous. It's simply outrageous. It's totally disrespectful of the maternal instinct and all of it, family ties, all of it.
Well, yes, of course, because some people are encouraged to be mothers and some people are discouraged from being mothers.
Right.
And it's not at all hard to figure out which party is which.
Right. Right. At 7:40, we will be opening up the telephone lines. If you'd like to call in, I'll give you that telephone number now. It's 937-5103, and I'll remind you again. Did something happen in Atlanta recently that you've been working on? I wasn't quite sure. I couldn't.
Oh, yes. The Georgia Right to Life folks have erected 65 billboards in the city of Atlanta, a majority black town, I might add, claiming that black children are an endangered species. And that's exactly the language from the billboard. And then the website that you're to look at is toomanyaborted.com. And they're basically saying that black children are at gravest risk from their own mothers because black women are, of course, exercising bodily self-determination and deciding which kids they're going to have, which ones they're not going to have. I mean, this has been a value in the African-American community since slavery. I mean, in the 35 years after slavery, we cut our own birth rate in half voluntarily because of the forced breeding. And so we've always seen as the ability to control our family size as part of our racial uplift out of poverty strategy. But all of a sudden, just last week, Georgia Right to Life decides that it's going to target the black babies for salvation. And so they put these billboards up, billboards provided, I might add, by CBS, the same people that did the Super Bowl ad, and started this whole firestorm of controversy because they chose, of course, the black neighborhoods to put these billboards in. They found a convenient couple of black spokespeople to claim that black children are enduring the holocaust of abortion, which is ridiculous. Not only is it very, very judgmental, but to me it's also anti-Semitic because when you compare what the Nazis did during the Holocaust in killing 6 million Jews with black women, individual black women deciding to control their body. I mean, I was on a radio debate earlier today, and I said, what are you doing, calling us the new Nazis? I mean, can't you tell the difference between state-directed population control and individual self-determination? And so it's been quite controversial. Now, the billboards, by the way, were really a publicity stunt to introduce legislation here in the state of Georgia targeting abortion clinics, trying to say that somehow they're soliciting through a race and a sex selection strategy women of color to come in to practice self-genocide. And so the legislation would allow women who've had abortions to come back and sue the providers for medical malpractice because they forced us to abort our babies.
Wow.
Take that on for size, right?
Really? Yeah.
So that's what we've been doing, and it's been in the New York Times and on CNN and MSNBC. We've been trying to fight these very well-financed people who themselves are racist because the whole phrase, black children are endangered species, first of all, starts off comparing our children to animals. Our children are exotic animals. Yeah. And so just the whole formulation and construction reveals their fairly racist intent, which is to use black women as a way to outlaw abortion for everybody.
Exactly. Exactly. So you've been countering it by speaking. I mean, you haven't taken down the signs or?
Not yet. The signs are still up there. The legislation was introduced into the Georgia legislature last week. We have a press conference scheduled tomorrow on the steps of the stairs of the state capitol. And we've got a number of prominent people to join us, author Alice Walker, Julian Bond, Faye Waddleton, the first black president of Planned Parenthood, Gloria Steinem. A number of people have joined us, just outraged that this campaign is happening and worried that even if the legislation doesn't pass, they will sufficiently succeed if they can shame black women into feeling guilty about the very necessary moral choices they have to make for themselves and their families. If you can make people feel guilty about their choices, about their decisions, then you really can control their minds.
Yep. Yep. It's a very volatile time that we're living in, really. On many levels.
Well, it's the best of times and the worst of times. I mean, I remember standing last January full of so much hope and promise with the election of President Obama.
Uh-huh.
And right now I am feeling very nervous slightly alarmed because he seems to be spending a lot of time trying to get the Republicans to play nice, and he can't seem to achieve that. And at the same time, those of us who are amongst his base are feeling a little like he was the prom date we had last night who can't remember our name this morning.
Really, yeah. Really, yes.
It's an interesting time.
Well, it is. And, of course, the focus on war and the spending and all the things that we're doing is just really, really, really awful.
Of course.
Yeah.
And so these are the challenges before us. But I'm really encouraged by the fact that everywhere I go and I get a chance to meet hundreds, if not thousands, of progressive people who are committed to creating a better world, who aren't just gazing at their belly buttons, trying to chant themselves out of misery, but really working to rebuild Haiti, to rebuild their own communities, to struggle against environmental racism. I mean, just are doing wonderful and great things. Matter of fact, on the radio show this afternoon, the woman who was in charge of these billboards kept saying, "Well, what if the next Martin Luther King gets aborted? What would you think then?" I said, "Well, what about the kids that are in foster care? 60% of them are African American. What if the next Martin Luther King is in foster care and you're not taking care of him?"
Uh-huh.
I mean, they actually do use these kind of illogical back at yous to try to make a point in a way that doesn't really make sense. And we could spend our lives talking about what if. I want to talk about what is.
For sure, for sure. And, of course, from time immemorial until the last 5,000 years, women did control their body. Obviously, whether to have a child or not, it's a very personal decision. It belongs to the woman. She's the one having the child.
Well, I have a rather crude way of saying it. I consider my pregnancies as private as my periods.
Really?
And if I'm not having a community discussion about menstruation and you're not helping me deal with that, then what are you doing in my panties?
Exactly. What else are you working on these days? I'm sure your plate is very full.
Well, we do have a full and active life. One of the projects that Sister Song has right now is that we're showing the link between reproductive justice and environmental hazards, looking at the many ways that communities of color are placed in very toxic surroundings, built on landfills and stuff due to racist zoning policies of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and what types of impacts that's having, like these cancer alleys that we can show where you have just huge pockets of people showing really rare and hard-to-treat cancers that shouldn't be happening in incredibly young people. We have a group of women that are working on the cancers that were due to the Vieques bombing down in Puerto Rico and raising that as a reproductive justice issue. So we're working on a lot of different areas and in a lot of different ways. We're working on immigrant rights. For example, our government had arbitrarily decided that every woman who was immigrating that was of appropriate age was mandated to receive the Gardasil vaccine, supposedly to prevent cervical cancer, which is a very expensive vaccine, and it's not at all required or necessary for a woman to immigrate here, for a child to immigrate here. So a group of our members had to take that campaign on. So we have to take on a lot, and we have to do a whole lot with only a very small staff and an even smaller budget. But we really have strength in numbers. Every time Sister Song has a meeting, you know, hundreds of women show up. And then we have our big conferences that are entitled Let's Talk About Sex. And at our sex conferences, we usually get over 1,000 people there. And our next one's going to be in Miami in July of 2011. And we're going to be talking about sex on the beach. And so we have a lot of fun, too.
That's great. That's important. I wonder about just getting in the streets, all of us, I mean. And just you've organized a huge gathering in Washington, how about organizing another one for everybody?
Well, we have 1,150,000 people come together for the 2004 March for Women's Lives.
Wow.
And while it was a wonderful gathering, I mean, it was the most massive thing you've ever seen. We had all the celebrities you could want, all the Hollywood people. We shut down Metro system, the subway system. I mean, it was just huge. But one thing I've learned is that those kinds of massive demonstrations really don't reflect the power of the small-minded people in Congress who make the decisions about our lives. We have to not only have the get-in-the-street strategy, but we also have to get in the halls of power strategy.
Mm-hmm.
One of my mentors is Billy Avery, who founded the National Black Women's Health Project. And Billy had a saying she always says. She said, you got to get a seat at the table, because if you're not at the table, that means you're probably on the menu.
That's pretty good.
And so we have to combine the street strategy and not over-romanticize that, because that march costs over $5 million to pull off.
Wow.
And so $5 million, you spend it on a one-day march, or do you spend it on empowering people to get up in the halls of Congress and say, how dare you take our human rights away?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to have a combination of very sophisticated strategies, meeting power with power. One thing that I'm critical of my feminist movement about is that we flinch when it comes to power politics, because we think that is such a reflection of the patriarchy that we actually become passive, aggressive around power.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
without power, like Frederick Douglass said long, long time ago, you can't get anything done in this capitalist country. And so we have to learn to be sophisticated in the use of power, in making our demands heard, not just getting a seat at the table, but getting the power to decide what's served at the table and who gets to eat. Those are the things that I'm beginning to understand more and more about. Since we've done the big marches, we've done the big demonstrations, now what?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly since we have a pro-choice president who we have to become the wind at his back to make him do the things that we want him to do. We have to learn to use power in a totally different way.
I know many, many people want to change things. We just can't seem to find the way to do it. Looking for the path, looking for the avenue.
Well, that's probably because we're looking for one path and one avenue when it's going to take many paths and many avenues. One of my own favorite sayings is that we have to learn the art of organizing people who don't agree with us. Historically, as the progressive movement, we spent a lot of energy trying to persuade everybody to agree with us. And the way I see it, a movement is people moving in the same direction who are thinking many different thoughts and ideas, but they agree to move in a given direction. But when people think one thought and move in the same direction, that's a cult. And we don't know the difference between movement building and cult building. And we need to have much more conversation about how to get people to agree to work with us who may not agree with us on a lot of things. Just like I said, Sister Song models having the pro-life and the pro-choice people moving in the same direction while fundamentally disagreeing over the status of abortion. But I don't even want to single out abortion, because within Sister Song, I mean, you take any given reproductive health issues, and if there's six people in the room, you're going to have 12 opinions. Some people think babies should be born at home under natural childbirth. I'm frankly an advocate of twilight birth. Knock me out. I don't want to be there for anything but holding the baby. But we're going to have that diversity of opinion and see it as a strength rather than as a weakness. And that's what we're not as adept at doing. organizing people who don't agree with us, but agree that better things can happen if we work together.
Mm-hmm. Well, that there has to be a common overall goal, and so that all of those disagreeing points can somehow be absorbed in the bigger picture.
Well, that's why I think the human rights framework is so useful. Because why can't we be the women's rights wing of the human rights movement, working with the environmental wing of the human rights movement, mm-hmm. and the anti-war wing of the human rights movement, and the gay and lesbian wing of the human rights movement? We can share a framework and still work on our particular issues and causes in a way that we don't contradict our fellow wings. For example, you can't do work against homophobia in a racist way. Or you can't do work against sexism in a homophobic way. Or you can't work to save the planet by encouraging people to go to war to keep all those third world people from using too much of the world's resources. I mean, those kinds of thinking patterns have to change. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that we all work on everything at the same time, but we work on what we choose to work on in a way that builds the human rights movement rather than get into what I often call the oppression Olympics, my pain is worse than your pain kind of thing.
Hey, we have a call. Good evening. You're on the air with Loretta Ross.
Hi. Thank you both so much for this amazing show. And Loretta, thank you so much for all your hard work and all the work that all your sisters are doing. I'm so impressed. And I wanted to ask if you could please speak to the recent Supreme Court ruling handing over more power to corporations to place elected officials and granting them the personage, and how that impacts our work.
Well, I think the Supreme Court certainly set us back at least 100 years,
yes,
where they expanded the 14th Amendment to allow corporations to basically claim human rights, that they have the right to use their unlimited resources to dictate our electoral processes. Now, we already knew that money contaminated democracy anyway,
right,
but when they're given a blank check and the carte blanche approval of the Supreme Court to buy and sell positions without any criminal consequences, we're all in trouble. So I really think that we need to have more conversations about direct democracy and what the vote really means when we're set basically seeing our elections bought and sold by corporate interests. I mean, corporate interests start all the wars around the world. As they are battling over oil and gold and diamonds, do you think the people of Africa, tribes that have lived together peacefully for thousands of years, that can't even afford bread, can buy machine guns and tanks? No, it's because one colonial power likes the oil and another colonial power likes the oil, so they arm different parts of the community, send them to war with each other, and whoever wins gets the oil. I mean, the people of Darfur would not be suffering genocide if their land wasn't desired by China for its oil.
Mm.
So I know I'm going far, but we've got money contaminating every human relationship, starting with our political process, but also our economic system and our environment. I mean, how could it go on?
Yeah.
But the reality is that we are not powerless. They can only take advantage of this situation and keep perpetuating this kind of injustice on us as long as we are seduced by Walmart and not really paying attention to what our human rights are, what we deserve as human beings, and how the government and the economy is supposed to be organized that it meets our needs.
There is also the thing of being propagandized, and that so many people watch TV and they believe, and since life is so difficult, they kind of become anesthetized and don't really think for themselves.
Well, I think that happens to a certain amount of the people, but I also think that it is so much easier to check out and not pay attention, because survival is very, very hard. So I don't blame people if they hunker down and duck their heads and just survive, because that is really often the only choice that they have.
Right.
It is a privilege not only to be conscious, but to have the time, the opportunity, the resources to actually work in social justice movements. I actually get very impatient with people who become very cynical and act like, well, you know, nothing's going to change and those people and all that kind of stuff. And I think they're taking the privilege of doing this work for granted, because most people really just are hanging on by their fingernails. I mean, my mother cleaned houses on her hands and knees. She had to lift up her skirts to show that her knees were sufficiently scarred so that white people could hire her to clean their houses.
Oh, you're kidding. Scarred
knees meant that you mopped the floor on your hands and knees.
Oh, my God.
So here I am a generation later, able to give speeches and to organize a movement. And I don't care how late I work at night and how early. And, you know, my face has been in Klan newspapers. Do I care? Because I'm not on my hands and knees. I am conscious, and I'm privileged to serve. I mean, and everybody that can do social justice work needs to see ourselves as privileged people.
Yeah, really.
It's the people who don't get a chance to fight against injustice that are the real downtrodden ones.
That's true. Do you know our time is coming to an end? It's gone very quickly. I thank you so much, Loretta. It's been wonderful to have you, and I'm sure everyone's feeling inspired and even hopeful in spite of it all. And we have a responsibility. So thank you for all of that and all the work that you do.
And I hope everybody joins Sister Song. We'd love to have y'all as members. And down on the beach with us in Miami in July of 2011, talking about sex.
Lovely. Thank you. I will join.
All right. Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Our life goes on along its merry way. We're looking for the good times, the fun and the play. While inside is an aching that won't go away, and we wonder why in heaven are we here today.